myself because this is a White House where everybody lies. The president lies to the American people. Sarah Huckabee stands in front of the country and lies every single day. You have to have your own back because otherwise you'll look back and you'll see 17 knives in your back.
It looks though,
that's not disloyalty. That's not disloyalty because let me tell you, Chuck, if I did not have this recording, people would still believe the false, incredible story that I was running around the White House, the false story that was told by a reporter and repeated by this network and other reporters that I tried to charge the residents of the White House. And it's a lie. If I didn't have this recording, listen, people would still think that I was trying to set off alarms. So, yes, I had to protect myself and I have no regret about it.
Former White House official Omarosa Manigault Newman speaking to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press yesterday. During that interview, she released a recording of President Trump's chief of staff firing her inside the most secure room in the White House. We'll hear more on whether she broke any laws later in the show. First, though, when you think of short-term rentals, such as Airbnb, you might picture someone renting out a back house or a spare room. Well, some L.A. property owners are turning entire apartment buildings into de facto hotels. And that's an issue for a city struggling with a housing shortage. It's an even bigger issue when those buildings are rent controlled. The city council has been considering new regulations, but it's been considering those new regulations for 3 years now. And as Press Play's Anna Scott found out, any action will be too late for some renters.
It's a sunny summer day in Venice Beach, and New Yorker Chris Hersomalis is on vacation with his cousin.
Just hanging out. We wanted to get by the beach, kind of relax for a few days because everything's been kind of hectic for both of us.
They're staying a block from the ocean at the Ellison Suites. Rooms go for a couple hundred bucks a night. You can book them at ellisonsuites.com. Chris likes the Ellison. It's quirkier than your typical hotel. He's really into the mural of singer Lana Del Rey painted on the side.
She's really awesome. I'd love to meet her someday.
Chris doesn't know that a woman named Kelly Day lives on the other side of that mural. Kelly works from home as a business consultant. All day, she says, she hears tourists coming and going and snapping photos with Lana Del Rey.
I can't get on calls. I can't show presentations. I have to hide in my bathroom when I want to get on a call with my clients. It's been a nightmare. Yeah.
See, the Ellison looks like a hotel. There's guests like Chris, a check-in desk by the elevator, but this is supposed to be a regular apartment building. That's what the housing department says it is. Out of almost 60 apartments, though, Kelly is only one of about a dozen full-time tenants left.
The Ellison is the poster child for the bad short-term rentals.
L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin represents Venice Beach. He says not all short-term rentals are bad, but an owner taking a whole apartment building off the regular rental market is bad, especially a rent-controlled building like the Ellison. LA has more than 100,000 rent-controlled buildings. In these buildings, landlords can only raise rents on tenants a tiny bit each year. Tenants are also protected from eviction. So Mike Bonin says turning these apartments to short-term rentals takes away a critical form of affordable, stable housing for a lot of people.
The Ellison is the greatest, most egregious example in the city of Los Angeles.
So why hasn't the city council passed its new short-term rental rules yet, making what's going on at the Ellison illegal? Well, Mike Bonin blames his colleagues. He says other city council members are slow because their districts don't have as many short-term rentals, or they didn't when all this started a few years ago.
Initially, when we started this legislation, most of the city, a lot of members of the council, didn't see this as an urgent issue. Are short-term rentals the cause of the housing crisis in Los Angeles? No, of course not. Are they a contributing factor? Absolutely yes, and they are a significant contributing factor in coastal areas, particularly in Venice.
Because tourists want to be by the beach. But these days, this isn't only happening in Venice.
Oh, we're seeing this as a widespread problem.
Larry Gross runs the Coalition for Economic Survival, a nonprofit that advocates for renters.
Whether you live in Studio City or Sherman Oaks or Koreatown or Fairfax area, no, you literally have a bullseye on your back if you're living in a rent-controlled unit, especially if you're a long-term tenant paying low rent.
Back at the Ellison,
welcome.
Dawood Farahani was born in Iran and has lived here at the Ellison since 1992. He pays $14.50 a month. Not super cheap, but a great deal a block from the ocean in L.A.
Mm-hmm. I see you have a
surfboard there. Do you surf?
Oh, sure. Yes, I do. I'm a surfer. Yes. Not at this time. It's almost 5 months I stopped it.
On a Saturday night, we stand by the building's front steps, listening to a singer in the courtyard. The Ellison hosts free shows for guests and anyone else who wants to show up every weekend. Besides musicians, these shows often include fire eaters, a magician, a fire dancer.
Belly dancer, yes, she's part of it. I mean, she's doing the belly dance.
A family walks by carrying boogie boards in from the beach. Another full-time tenant, Brian Averill, says besides families, a lot of young people come here to party.
Yeah. Someone jumped off that roof, someone jumped off that roof, yes, onto the fourth floor there. Someone jumped off this roof onto the sidewalk.
As we're talking, the landlord, a man named Lance J. Robbins, walks by.
Lance Robbins?
He's a 70-year-old guy with a mustache. He won't do a taped interview. And a few minutes later, a manager approaches.
Unfortunately, this is a private property. Uh-huh. I'm going to have to ask you to leave unless we give you authorization to be here or we had some kind of...
Lance Robbins isn't just some anonymous landlord. He's notorious in Los Angeles. At one time, he had more convictions than any landlord prosecuted by a special L.A. slum housing task force. In the past, he's been sued by the city, lost his real estate broker's license, and even been sentenced to jail over health and safety issues at various buildings. Now he's being sued by 15 current and former tenants at the Ellison. They're accusing him of generally making life miserable in order to force everyone out and convert the whole building to an unlicensed hotel.
We didn't have garbage pickup for a week.
The inner courtyard is used for construction in the daytime.
One day I don't have a hot water, one day I don't have a cold water, one day I don't have a both cold and hot water. Yeah, both. Yeah.
The claims also include no heat for one tenant, mailbox tampering for another, and one who says a building manager assaulted him, among other allegations. The harassment claims will work their way through court, but it's already illegal to run an unlicensed hotel in Los Angeles, so why hasn't the city cracked down on the Ellison?
Well, there's a number of reasons it's legal and also not an unlicensed hotel.
Meet Thomas Nitti. He's a longtime lawyer for the Ellison's owner, Lance Robbins. On a Wednesday morning at his office, he's wearing sneakers and athletic shorts and sitting behind a desk covered with tall stacks of paper. Before the city could go to Lance, he went to them. Thomas Nitti filed papers with the Housing and Planning Departments arguing that short-term rentals at the Ellison are perfectly legal. It's still under consideration. Thomas Nitti says the Ellison isn't a hotel at all. It's an apartment building that happens to offer nightly rentals.
We've all heard of people who live in some of the Beverly Hills hotels and stay there for years and years. That doesn't make the hotel an apartment building. I was reading recently of an 80-year-old woman that lives on a cruise ship and never leaves. That certainly doesn't make the cruise ship an apartment building.
Then there's this.
Another reason Mr. Robbins can operate the way he does is Los Angeles has no law against short-term rentals.
That's right. LA's city attorney, Mike Feuer, sued some other landlords in Venice for turning rent-controlled buildings into short-term rentals. But a few months ago, a judge in one of those cases said, actually, there's no law saying you can't rent apartments by the night. A spokesman for the city attorney told me that a different judge in another case sided with the city and, quote, we stand ready to pursue these cases. But if the city council had passed its short-term rental law 3 years ago, there wouldn't be this mess of confusion. The law would be clear. You can't run rent-controlled buildings like hotels, period. As long as it remains unclear, some property owners will write their own rules. In Hollywood, near the Walk of Fame, Lance Robbins runs another rent-controlled building,
the Alexa Artiste Apartments.
Or, if you look it up on hotels.com, the Canterbury Suites. Nightly rentals cost about the same as the Ellison. Back at the Ellison, Dawood Farahani says the conflict with Lance stresses him out.
I'm tired.
Lance actually tried to evict Dawood. The case went all the way to a jury trial last year. Dawood won, but he's had some health problems and says anxiety over his living situation saps his energy.
I don't have a life.
So why doesn't he just move out?
Over 25 years I'm living here. This is my home.
For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up on the program, did Omarosa break any laws when she taped the president without his knowledge or his chief of staff in the Situation Room? Our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, will be here to talk about that next on Press Play.
Hey, it's Bob Carlson from Unfictional on KCRW, and I've got a challenge for you. You know that smartphone in your pocket? Now is your chance to use it to make great radio. That's right, I want you to participate in our 24-hour radio race. Do it with a team, do it solo. Either way, we want to hear your original audio masterpiece. Register today. The race is on Saturday, August 25th. Go to kcrw.com/radio race, and good luck.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Omarosa Manigault Newman released another recording today. She says it's of a phone call she had with President Trump the day after she was fired by White House Chief of Staff John Kelly.
Omarosa, what's going on? I just saw on the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, nobody even told me about it. Nobody. Wow. You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it.
This comes after Omarosa released a recording yesterday of her own firing from inside the Situation Room. That's the most secure room in the White House. President Trump fired back on Twitter. He called her a loser and vicious, but not smart. Others in the White House say the recording is illegal and a threat to national security. Here to talk about this is our regular legal correspondent, Jessica Levinson, a law professor at Loyola Law School. Hello.
Hello.
Let's preface this with the fact that there's a book coming out tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness. Is she on a book tour?
She's on a book tour. And she's obviously getting lots of publicity, lots of free publicity to promote it. Let's start with that recording in the Situation Room. Is that a crime to record anything in this room, this top secret room?
So it could be. What we have to unpack a couple of things. One is, where were they, generally speaking? They were in the District of Columbia. And D.C. is a one-party consent jurisdiction when
like
it comes
New York.
To, like New York, unlike California, when it comes to taping conversations. So if you're having a conversation and you consent to recording, you are one of the two parties who consents, and that is permissible. The difference here, of course, is that they weren't just at a DC bistro having a lovely lunch. They were in not just the White House, but in the Situation Room, which is like the inner sanctum, the holy of holies of security.
This is
places,
the place
supposedly.
Where we've seen the picture of President Obama watching as the Osama bin Laden raid happened. It's that room.
It is that room. This is where you decide on life or death decisions. This is where we talk about nuclear options. This is where we talk about troop movements. This is supposed to be the most secure place, except apparently when it comes to Omarosa and General Kelly. And so the question becomes, when you're in the Situation Room, did you have security clearance? Because then you might be breaking that security clearance to record. And did you release any information that was classified? I think both of those answers in this case look like they're no. She did not have security clearance, and she's not releasing anything classified. She's releasing something salacious. Mm. And so what people have said, which I think is exactly right, this is a kind of unimaginable breach in terms of rules, in terms of protocol, in terms of procedure. It's very much understood that you don't walk into the Situation Room with electronic devices, that you would never do something like tape in this room, except, of course, apparently it's not understood by everyone.
It does seem like it's straight out of a reality TV show plot.
In a shocking twist, two reality stars who find themselves in the White House continue to act like reality stars.
And he has been known to tape conversations as well.
Yeah. I like that he talks about the executive branch of the federal government as a pretty big operation or a big operation.
All right. So she says she has even more tapes. Could there be any legal move on the part of the White House to prevent her from releasing those?
Well, again, I think we have to look at what was her security clearance? It looks like she did not have security clearance, and or was any of the information classified? And so, again, if the answer to both of those questions is no, then I think that what we have here is the Trump administration having the option of political pressure, of saying, do you really want to continue releasing this? Of course, you don't want to get to the point where you're threatening somebody. And you know, that's a fine line between exerting political pressure and a criminal threat.
Well, speaking of threatening, she says that Kelly threatened her in this conversation, in this part of the conversation. Let's listen.
But it's very, very important, I think, that you understand that there are some serious legal issues that have been violated, and you're open to some legal action that we hope, I think we can control, right?
Any idea what he's talking about there?
No, so this can sometimes be a negotiating tactic. You know, there could be some legal issues. We think you should go quietly into the night. There's some talk about her misusing government cars. So he may have also been fishing, hoping that she thought, oh, my goodness, you found out that? Well, you're right. I really should not write a book, not tape anything, not release the tapes and be quiet. Apparently, that strategy was not terrifically successful for General Kelly. But, you know, he was, I have to imagine, purposely quite vague in saying there are things that we don't want you to there are things that you're not going to want to talk about here.
Mm. And then also the president said or tweeted that she had signed an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, and that she would obviously be violating it with this book and with these interviews and with these recordings. Can anything legal happen as a result of that?
So there's some really interesting legal questions surrounding these NDAs, which are not typically used in this type of situation for a White House counsel. And so one, if it is upheld and she's actually breaking the NDA, then she is breaking a private contract. And there can be legal repercussions, just like a contract to buy a car, buy a house.
But can she can it be a private contract if she's a government employee?
Well, it can be, I should say, a contract between basically two people.
Okay.
So, but there is a question as to whether this NDA is unlike other NDAs, meaning it just goes against public policy to have a public official, to have someone who works at the White House, sign these non-disclosure agreements. And I understand this is something that the ACLU is actually arguing now, which is you can't impose NDAs in this situation.
Is that common that government officials sign NDAs?
My understanding is that it is not common. It is probably more common than taping in the Situation Room, but I think it is certainly not normal. What's normal is, for instance, if you're a celebrity, you have your babysitter sign an NDA. What's not normal is you're the president of the United States, you hire someone who is a contestant on your reality show, and you have them sign an NDA.
Lots of not normal happening these days.
Yes.
Well, it is normal to have you every Monday and a delight. So thank you very much.
Well, it's a big operation. I like to be here for it. So thank you.
If only it were a big operation. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, Instagram in Iran.
It's so big that even the supreme leader of the country, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has an Instagram page. And you'd be maybe even more surprised that he's by far not the most popular person on Instagram.
How the Islamic Republic is negotiating the modern internet age. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The situation in Turkey is getting worse. The country's currency, the lira, just keeps dropping. Foreign investors are pulling out of the country, and there are worries other emerging economies could be hurt too. Turkey does have internal economic problems, inflation being one of them. But tensions with the United States are also a factor. On Friday, President Trump said he would double tariffs on steel and aluminum from Turkey. And to explain what's going on now and why Turkey's problems are increasingly the rest of the world's problems, we have Henri Barki. He is Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Hi.
Hi.
What is going on with Turkey's currency, the lira? Why is it seemingly in free fall?
Well, the currency was under pressure because the Turkish economy was not doing very well of late. The inflation rate was very has been very high. The central bank, which was supposed to increase interest rates to combat the inflation rate, was essentially stopped by the President Erdogan from increasing interest rates because he does not believe in interest rates. Also, there were elections in Turkey in June whereby all powers are concentrated in the presidential palace, which means that people's confidence in the ability of the Turkish government to function in a normal way. I mean, the Turkish economy is a serious economy. It is, after all, the 17th largest economy of the world, so you expect it to act in ways in which they conform to international standards. But when you have a president who essentially can tell judges to do X or Y or Z, then you don't really have confidence in the executive power. So that also contributed to weakening of the Turkish lira. The president also appointed his son-in-law in a combined super ministry for both finance and treasury. His son-in-law was minister of the energy before, but he doesn't really have the knowledge and the experience to run essentially the Turkish economy. So all of these factors contributed to a weakening of the lira. But the coup de grace came, if you want, from the tit-for-tat or the escalation of tensions with the United States and President Trump's decision to impose sanctions on Turkey, trade sanctions, but for political reasons.
And this is all, or at least nominally, because of this evangelical Presbyterian minister from North Carolina, Andrew Brunson, that Turkey has detained for more than a year. And the president said, well, you have to release him. What does Turkey accuse him of doing?
First of all, it's not just the pastor, Andrew Brunson, who has been in jail now for almost 2 years. In addition to him are three Turkish nationals who have been employees of the U.S. government, and they were arrested. Two of them are in jail, one is under house arrest. And there are also, we don't know how many, we only know the name of one, Turkish Americans who have also been jailed. All of these people are essentially being accused of ludicrous, inconsistent, made-up charges. I mean, they're conspiracy theories that have been marshaled into court cases. I mean, the Turkish government also has an arrest warrant on me because I was there on July 15, 2016, running a conference, and they're accusing me of masterminding the coup, among other things. And the Turkish press being 95% now controlled by the government, you cannot take this indictment apart and show people that it is really fiction. I mean, in Turkey and United States, you have two somewhat mercurial leaders who act very much on their instincts and impulses and make policy not the way policy should be made. So you have also a clash now of two very large egos.
Right. And so now you have the sanctions and you have the tariffs on steel and aluminum and you have the lira plummeting. How is it that the lira is affecting world markets now?
What I think people are afraid of is that you may end up having a contagion effect in emerging markets. Already Argentina is in trouble. So, but you have a series of large economies, emerging market economies, that also have foreign exchange exposure. That is to say, they owe money in dollars and their currency is losing value. So the problem is not unique to Turkey, but when it plays itself out with Turkey in such a dramatic fashion, with Trump tweeting and Erdogan saying this is war against us, we're going to defend ourselves and we're going to retaliate. So it raises the visibility of the crisis.
But isn't there a problem that Turkey has been basically relying on cheap foreign debt for a huge building boom, and that these people who borrowed money now to build the skyscrapers and to build this massive airport that they're trying to complete won't be able to pay their debts back because, it will just cost more because the lira is weaker against the dollar. It'll cost more to pay back the debts.
They borrowed money, cheap money. Turkish growth was fueled by these massive infrastructure projects. The problem is the government guaranteed the operators of the bridges and the tunnels that they will make a certain amount of money. And if they don't, the government now is on the hook to make up for the difference. So the government says, we guarantee there will be 100,000 cars crossing this bridge every day. And what happens, and this is exactly what's happening now, only 50,000 cars cross. So this is going to be a chain reaction that's going to also affect the Turkish governmental budget. The only good news here, and I should stress here, is that Turkish government debt is relatively low. There is room, if you want, for the Turkish government to absorb some of the debt. And remember, we still have organizations like the IMF that have not yet stepped in because the Turks have not asked the IMF to step in. If things were to get that dire, they will first go to the IMF before we see major defaults. And also, all of the debt is not coming due at the same time. It is going to by quarter. So you have time to adjust.
But so what it could mean, but what it could mean is that future investment won't be as plentiful in terms.
Oh, absolutely. That there's no question. I mean, the Turkish economy is going to contract, and is going to contract significantly, much more than what people expected before. What's going to happen now is that you're going to see a major recession in Turkey. But a recession in Turkey is not going to affect the international economic system. Yes, it's a G20 economy, but compared to the big boys or girls, United States, China, Britain, France, etc., it's quite insignificant. We should not be alarmists, that's what I'm saying.
Henri Barkey, his senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dutch journalist Thomas Erdbrink arrived in Iran for the first time back in 1999, and he fell in love.
Yeah, I could have married a girl from the Dutch countryside. It would maybe would have been different, and maybe in many ways it would have been easier, but I'm happy I choose you.
Of course you should be.
He fell in love with an Iranian woman and then with her country. And he's been living in Iran for 17 years now. Thomas Erdbrink is one of just a few Western journalists allowed to work there. He's reported on elections, on sanctions, on nuclear negotiations. But for his latest project, he wanted to present another side of Iran, the human side, how people actually live there. His new two-part documentary about Iran airs tonight and tomorrow on PBS. And Thomas Erdbrink joins us now. Welcome.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, so first of all, why are you just one of the few Western journalists to be accredited there? Is it because you married an Iranian woman?
Well, I wish there was such a magic rule to being here, but I think it's basically because I just stuck around when a lot of other people left, and also some people were expelled, and one that we know very well in the United States, Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post correspondent, was arrested. I've managed to avoid all of that. I've had some difficult moments. That's definitely true for me. But I never left. And some people think I'm a bit nuts, but I'm still here.
And the Iranian officials, they had to approve the making of this movie. And it took a long time, correct?
It took them 4 years to give the approval to make the documentary. And truth be told, then they weren't so busy with it anymore. I mean, they looked at the documentary after it had aired in the Netherlands and in other countries in Europe, and also on the New York Times at the time. And they gave me a permit to do a second one. They weren't very happy with some of the characters that I talked to in the documentary. But yeah, truth be told, they still gave me a second permit.
Well, one of the characters that they don't like is this guy who's called Mr. Big Mouth. Is that he calls himself that?
Well, he doesn't mind to be called like that, but he of course has a name, and a lot of people say it's a bit degrading to call him Mr. Big Mouth. But here in Iran, everyone does. And why do they do this? Because Mr. Big Mouth is the man who will stand in front of any demonstration with his mouth wide open, and he will shout, "Death to America." And of course, that is what we know Iran for in the United States, for these anti-American slogans and his anti-American behavior. And I decided to, you know, visit him at his house.
And did you find him reasonable? How did you find him?
Well, I mean, there were not a lot of things we had in common other than the fact that we were both wearing pants and a shirt. But beyond that, I did find it very interesting that he was open to talking to me, and he wanted to explain why he shouted "Death to America" even in his sleep. And as you follow this guy, and we follow him in both films, you actually get to see that he is, on one hand, yeah, a bit of a silly man, and on the other hand, also, and we'll see that in part two, a very dangerous man who has done dangerous things. I find it very interesting to talk to all sorts of Iranians of all walks of life, and yeah, he is one of them.
But do you see him as somehow emblematic of at least one faction of Iranian society?
No, he is really a foot soldier for Iran's hardliners. He's the kind of guy that you see on the news when you talk about Iran. He is the guy that is almost a poster boy for the way we see those Iranians being anti-American. And as you see the documentary, you'll see that he's definitely not, and there's many, many other sides to this country.
So Mr. Big Mouth, he shouts death to America, and there are plenty of others. You film in the mosque saying the same thing, being encouraged to do so by the religious leaders. And I guess I'm wondering, outside the mosque, how ordinary Iranians in general feel about America now that sanctions have been reimposed and the nuclear agreement, the United States has exited from the nuclear agreement?
Well, it was definitely a big blow to many people that President Trump decided to withdraw the United States from the nuclear agreement, because with all its faults, the nuclear agreement brought the hope, at least, of a better future, the hope that foreign companies, namely European companies, would come here and invest and give jobs to people. If you take a recent event that I witnessed at the local office here of a Dutch airline, the local employees were told that they could no longer work for the company because the company was packing up. All the local employees were women, some of them divorced, some of them single, with child. Yeah, they were all fired, and they had to deal with this new reality that they no longer had a job. And this, of course, had to do with the sanctions. But at the same time, a lot of Iranians are now at the point that they blame their own leaders just as much and maybe even more than the United States. They point at the mismanagement, at the economical corruption, and of course at this really sometimes suffocating rules that Iran's leaders want their people to adhere to. So it's no longer such a clear picture that the United States policies are all bad and their own leaders' policies are all good, on the contrary.
Now, in the second part of the documentary, which airs tomorrow night, you come here to Los Angeles, Tarangelis,
yeah,
as they call it here, where there are a lot,
yeah,
of Iranian-Americans, a lot of Persians. And your wife, Nusha's sister, she moved to Los Angeles several,
yes,
years ago. And you go to visit her, and she has a young daughter. She's what? She's late teens, early
19.
20s? 19. Who is really into Iran. She came here when she was 9 years old, and she has all these tattoos that, yeah, celebrate being Iranian. I just want to play a clip of tape of her and her mom.
Look at me. I'm more liberal. Like, I don't cover myself. It's like, you know, I've totally, like, adapted to the way girls dress here, live here, you know? But isn't it funny that I'd be okay with covering myself for the whole summer in that weather than be here in shorts and bikinis all the time? Like, what? I just don't get it.
Okay, so that's her mom saying, I just don't get it. Can you talk about that? Why is she wants to move back to Iran, but she came here when she was 9 years old, so she hasn't lived there as an adult. Why she wants to move back there?
I think she symbolizes a feeling that a lot of migrants have. You start over in a new country, a country that holds lots of problems, the United States, a big melting pot. But at the same time, you are still very proud of your own culture, of where you come from. And you also sort of have the idea, in her case, because she's so young, that you miss certain things. Now, she is a teenager, and we've had lots of arguments because we've lived together. Those 9 years that she was here, I taught her how to swim and everything. So I spoke to her and said, you know, be in the States. The States is good because you get a good education. And now she thinks differently. But we've also interviewed two other people who live in and around L.A., a singer, Andy Madadian, who can never return to Iran and who very much still misses his country, and someone who owns a garage, Gorgen, an Iranian-Armenian who's been in Burbank for 25 years. Now, Gorgon is sort of famous because he had a YouTube hit, if you will, with an advertisement for his company called Shift It. And the song goes, shift it, shift it, forwards, backwards, shift it, shift it, forwards, backwards. When you see it, he is really funny. And he's a man, he's been on the Ellen DeGeneres show. Richard Gere brings his car to his garage. But then when he starts speaking in Farsi, his eyes start tearing up. He talks about how much he misses his country. And he knows there are all these faults. But he still feels like an immigrant in the United States. And he misses where he came from. And I think this goes also for my wife's niece and the singer, is that they are in the United States. They like the United States. At the same time, they miss where they're from.
And that lifestyle in Iran is starting to open up, at least online. Instagram, I was surprised to see in your movie, is huge in Iran.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. It's so big that even the supreme leader of the country, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has an Instagram page. And you'd be maybe even more surprised that he's by far not the most popular person on Instagram, which is an Iranian actress with, I don't know, 6 million followers or something. Instagram has really torn down the walls of the public and private. And I think we're very used to that in the United States. But in Iran, a country where on the street you have to live or you have to dress in the way Iran's leaders want, the compulsory veil, a long coat for women, men are not allowed to wear shorts, to suddenly see that the private lives that people live, where you can be yourself, or you can have parties, where you can dress the way you want, to suddenly see those private lives on Instagram, open there for everyone to see, has really changed this country in a way that, yeah, social media, of course, has changed the entire world, but especially a closed country like Iran.
Hmm. Your wife, interestingly, has decided to wear a headscarf as you're filming, because she'll be seen by Iranian authorities who watch the movie, and she's a pretty famous photographer. What went behind her calculations?
Well, when we shot the first film in 2014, Iran wasn't the same country as it is now. There were no protests over the headscarf. A lot of Iranian women at the time, they felt that there were other things to fight for. For instance, equal divorce rights or equal inheritance rights. And my wife at the time, being very much in the public eye here, didn't feel like, just for my documentary, to make a political statement, because she says, and she will still say, I make those statements in my pictures. She is a photographer for the famous Magnum agency, and she travels across the world, and she does a lot of work in Iran. But you'll see in the same scene that her sister and her mother, who are less known, more ordinary, if you will, they don't wear the scarf. And I think it's very interesting how you see that change, because if you go from the first film that we made in 2014 to the second film in 2018, we suddenly meet this woman, Banafshe, who has stood on a telecom box next to the street, taken off her headscarf, paraded it in the air like a flag in a sign of protest. So we go to her house and we drive with her to town and we talk with her about her reasons why she was protesting against the compulsory hijab.
And she could have been put in prison and sentenced to many years.
Yes, she could have, because as we also show in the movie, there are other cases of women making similar protests who've gone to jail for 20 years. I've got 20 years of probation. So this lady, Banafshe, she ran a very big risk by doing this, but she said, I want to do this because I believe in this. And we also show a protest that she did in Tehran's metro. And Banafshe said, I want to do this, I want to show this, but she also left for another country where she's living now, and she's no longer in Iran.
Was there anything you wanted to put in this documentary that you couldn't because you were afraid of being on the wrong side of the Iranian officials?
Well, I think if you live here for 17 years, and I've had many stories about many nasty things on the front page, and in the series, we actually end with a story of a friend of mine whose father dies in an Iranian prison, then what the Iranian leaders say or think should be secondary. But what I don't want is to bring people in deep trouble. So what I really would have loved to film are Iranian social gatherings, the way people at night come together, how they play music, how they read the famous Iranian poem Hafez, or how they just party or anything. So that was hard to do, and I had to forgo on that.
All right. Thomas Erdbrink, he's Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times. The new Frontline documentary, Our Man in Tehran, starring Thomas Erdbrink, will air on PBS in two parts tonight and tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, school starts tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow for LA's public schools. A lot of high school students will take AP classes to boost their GPAs, but are they worth it? Increasingly, education experts say no. That is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Can you believe it? School starts tomorrow for LA Unified. High school students who hope to get into a selective college have probably signed up for a few AP classes. And with the bump they provide to GPAs, they're pretty much a necessity for many schools these days. For example, the average high school GPA of a UCLA freshman is well over 4.0. But there is a revolution brewing, or at least beginning. As the school year was ending in June, seven of the top private schools in Washington, D.C. announced they were dropping AP classes. They say the classes aren't necessary and they put too much emphasis on memorization, rote memorization. Some education experts are not surprised by this decision. Denise Pope is one of them. She's a senior lecturer at Stanford's Graduate School of Education.
Well, one of the things that many independent schools across the country and a few public schools are finding is that AP courses can be very limiting. You are required to teach a specific curriculum. Oftentimes that curriculum is extremely narrow, which means you have to get from point A to point Z in very short time period, cover a ton of content because it's going to be on the test at the end of the school year. So the content of the curriculum, the way that you have to teach it, you might not be able to do as much project-based learning or experimentation or field work. And it's also narrow in that in order to get to that coverage, teachers feel that they have to do more lecturing, which we know is not necessarily the best form of pedagogy. So there's a lot of reasons to consider eliminating AP courses because we know it's not, in some of the cases, not really the best way for kids to learn the material.
And will those students be able to bump up their GPA in other ways?
So it's interesting that you ask that. There are many colleges out there, particularly large public universities like the University of California, that looks at GPA as one of the factors. If you're in, let's say, California, for instance, you can actually apply for a waiver as a school, and you can say, our kids are not going to be taking APs at our school, but here's what the curriculum will be that they're taking. Can you grant us the ability to bump their GPA, even though it doesn't have the AP label? And the University of California has done that with many schools that have done away with advanced placement courses in the state of California. So those kids absolutely will have a higher GPA. They'll be able to bump their GPA just like the kids coming from schools that have advanced placement courses.
And those courses would be honors courses, I assume.
Yeah, sometimes they have funny names like advanced topic, but yes, honors, advanced topic. They're courses that will go deep, that will challenge rigorously, and that curriculum has been approved by the University of California to merit that extra bump.
Well, meanwhile, you have public schools which serve low-income students or minority students primarily adopting AP classes and AP tests as a way to try to narrow the education gap.
Right. So it's sort of a mixed bag, right? On the one hand, we do know that some AP courses, because of the level of challenge, are really helping kids all over get excited and learn the material. Often we see kids are more engaged when they take an AP course. But the flip side is also happening, that you can have kids who are really not prepared to take an AP course and they're pushed into these AP courses because the school actually gets a little bit more money. Sometimes the school gets a higher rating when they have more kids taking more APs. So we do have schools, particularly in under-resourced areas, where kids are not even reading at a college level yet, but they're taking what is called an AP course, and they may not do well. They may actually never pass the test at the end of the course, and it may actually be more frustrating than educational for them. So you have to be really careful. Not all AP courses are created equal. AP teachers don't need to take a particular course or professional development series to learn to be an AP teacher. And a lot of these kids really aren't prepared to handle the AP classes that they're being put into in some of those schools.
Well, why don't they require the teachers to have specialized training?
Well, the College Board, which runs the advanced placement curriculum, basically suggests that teachers should do this, but to be honest, there are so many courses out there, there are so many teachers, that they haven't figured out a way to require it and make it doable to allow all those courses to take place. So it would be great to have teachers learn to do this. It would be great to really rethink the curriculum in a way that teachers could teach in the way they know they should and want to, and not feel so handcuffed by the need to cover all this material in such a short time. And the College Board is aware of this. They're working on making changes to certain subject areas. They changed the AP US history over time, and it's gotten better, but it's still a lot to cover. And in education, we try not to talk about coverage anymore as much as deeper learning and really mastering the content.
Yeah. Well, who designs the courses? The College Board?
Well, that's another interesting question. Actually, you're allowed to design your own course, but it has to cover certain topics. So you can design your own curriculum as an AP teacher, but you have guidelines that you must follow, and they have to approve it. The College Board has to approve it. So you are very limited, but you do have the ultimate say in design. And what a lot of teachers do is, in fact, my own kids' AP US teacher basically said, look, I'm going to cover it in this way. We may run into a slight problem on the test because we're going to skip some parts here. But this way, I know I'm doing my job as a teacher. I can go deeper in the skills that I need you to know.
Don't you get college credit if you pass an AP class and you get the 3 points or more?
Well, in some colleges you do, but what we're seeing more and more is that the colleges are not accepting those as credit as much as admissions tokens. So in a lot of places, they look to see that you've had AP classes to show that you can take a challenging curriculum, or like the University of California, it's a bump in your GPA, but you may not be able to actually get college credit for that course. It really depends at the university that you're applying to. Some of them will only give you credit for a score of 4 or 5, even though a 3 is considered passing. Some won't give credit at all for any score, and others will make you take the next higher class to prove that the AP course basically did its job. So you should check that out depending on the college you're applying to.
Denise Pope is a senior lecturer at Stanford's Graduate School of Education. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And the resident Norwegian is with us, Christian Bordahl. Hi.
Back in action. Hey there.
Back
How's
in
it going?
Action.
Well, I reached out to listeners to ask them whether they think high school students are just under too much pressure these days with these AP classes and stuff. And Fernando Aquino says no. AP classes are for advanced students, and if they're not cut out for the material, then they can take regular classes. But Andrew Rose says, I don't think teaching to these tests is strong education. In fact, it's just the opposite of strong education, which is founded on critical thinking. And BBY Grimes says, if people developed a stronger sense of discipline and enjoyment of the learning process, I don't think high school would be as stressful.
Okay.
So a lot more comments at KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you so much, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.